Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We have both Kirk and JB this evening. We're also on the just getting past the celebration of Shavuot. So happy Shavuot to one and all. Shavuot is the celebration where Yahweh's Spirit enriches and empowers us, enlightens us. We are given the opportunity to be more effective spokespeople on behalf of Yahweh's message. It's about where with Pesach we are our days are elongated. We become immortal. On Matzah we are perfected, such that on Purim we are adopted. But staying as babies doesn't do God or us much good. So on Shavuot, it is God's responsibility to raise us so that we're enriched, empowered, and enlightened. I do want to have a shout-out to Steve Smyrna. He's typically goes underneath the name of Bloodbath on the chat room. I've sent him an email. Other people are trying to reach him. I understand he had surgery a little over a week ago, and we do need to know his whereabouts. He usually posts the show on his YouTube channel. He hasn't been able to do that. We have a lot of concerned people that are trying to reach out to him and find out how he is. So if you're one of those who speaks with him or know of his condition, please let us know and see if we can get Steve to check in with us. We hope all is well. On the book update, the crew is still busy at it. We are maybe 10 pages away from completing the volume 4 of Yada Yama. That'll make the 16th book in the new series. Volume 4 of Yada Yama is about Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. So obviously we're about 10 pages or so from completing the presentation of Bukhutim. This was a rough week for Israel. It was a rough week for me as well. I have a very difficult time with how the world responds to Israel, and particularly how idiots like we have a congresswoman, Ilhan Omar. She's a Democrat from Minnesota and a Muslim. She came out this week and say that this whole fighting episode between the fakestinians, and that is a kind way to speak of them, because there is no such thing as a Palestinian. It's disgraceful even to suggest there is such thing as a Palestinian, since the last of them was killed. bikes 2,500 years ago. JB, that may be your bike that has really got a lot of background noise, so we probably need to mute it unless you're speaking.
Try hanging up and calling in again.
Okay, yeah, it's really got a lot of background noise. Yes, so she tweeted, Palestinians, of which there is no such thing, are being attacked on their holy site. It isn't their holy site. It happens to be the Temple Mount. The only reason that Muslims are there is because Muhammad lied. Muhammad claimed in the middle of the night while sleeping with a six-year-old girl, committed an act of pedophilia while trying to escape the verbal abuse he was enduring on behalf of the Meccans, because he claimed that all of Allah's messengers spoke on behalf of Satan, and he added three goddesses to his pantheon of gods. And so he was getting a lot of flack, and he needed a break, so he did what we call today a staycation. While he stayed in his bed with the six-year-old Ashi, he then pretended that he flew to Jerusalem, which I don't think he knew if it was east, west, north, or south, on a winged ass. Now, mind you, asses don't have wings. Most certainly, asses don't fly, and no one has ever flown an ass from Mecca to Jerusalem. But nonetheless, in the middle of the night, I guess he had a modern version or an ancient version of GPS. He managed to fly on his winged ass, who was obviously smarter than him, because it took him to Jerusalem, where he claims he had meetings in the temple. Of course, this was around just shy of 700 CE, and the temple had been destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE, but he was too stupid to know that. And the Muslims still claim Jerusalem as their holy site, even though their wannabe prophet lied to them about going there. And of course, he claimed that he met with all of the Hebrew big shots like Adam and Moses and David, and he even met with Esau. He didn't know the actual name of Yosha, and so some rabbi pulled his leg and said, well, that was Esau, because, well, Esau is the person that God called out by name and said, I hate him. And Esau became the Christian Jesus in the Quran. Oh, this thing is such an absolute pile of lies. And to get to heaven, Muhammad claimed that his wild and winged ass leapt from the what is now the Dome of the Rock in the middle of the Temple Mount up to heaven, which I guess the only way to get to heaven is not through Mecca, but through Jerusalem. But nonetheless, he leapt to heaven, and en route to heaven, he went to hell. And hell is where he found women like Representative Ilhan Omar, the Democrat from Minnesota, hung by their breasts. And when he asked why hell is filled with women who are hanging from meat hooks by their breasts, he was told that because they did not appreciate their husbands. So much for you progressives. And finally, upon making it to the seventh heaven, he asked Allah what he wanted, and Allah's choice was, I want to be mooned 50 times a day. And out of this outright fabrication of reality, in the midst of committing an act of pedophilia, in the midst of having confessed to the satanic verses, Muslims claim the Temple Mount as their holy site. And this numbskull, Ilhan Omar, calls it their holy site. The Palestinians are being attacked on their holy site. What in the hell is wrong with you? The Philistines lived in Gaza. You're in Gaza. The Philistines were killed 2,500 years ago. Jerusalem has never been a holy site or the site of a Muslim, ever. Good God, woman, wake up. And all of you progressives that are too damn stupid to correct her, that allow her in your committees and don't censure her for this stupidity and pretend that somehow there's a place called Palestine and a displaced people called Palestinians when neither are true. And then this numbskull says the level of injustice and cruelty is unacceptable because they were attacked during their Friday prayers. Bullshit! What in the hell again are you drinking? It was the Muslims that waltzed out of their mosque with Molotov cocktails and rocks and started pelting everyone that they could find anywhere near the Temple Mount. And they became riotous. So Israel, who the last thing they want to do is confront a Muslim. Israel's security forces, not the IDF, went there to restore calm. And they were attacked. And rather than killing the attackers, who were trying to kill them, they instead shot tear gas and rubber bullets. And yet, this nitwit, completely out of touch with reality, wants to blame the Jews, as do progressives and liberals everywhere. She then says, Israel's military functions with impunity. It was at Israel's military. It was security forces. Hey, where's their police? Can't you get anything right? Firing tear gas is Palestinians celebrating the ceasefire after Friday prayers. Why in the hell was there a ceasefire? Because Muslims thought it would be a swell idea to shoot rockets into Israel. Now, there's something wrong with your culture. If you're in the modern age and the best thing you've got is a big damn pipe bomb that half of which don't even make it outside of your own territory, and rocks. Oh, and of course, balloons carrying flammables and Molotov cocktails. What is it about Islam that is so regressive that even when the world slathers them with money, that's the best they have? And then there's idiots like this that say, well, the big problem was, in fact, the Washington Post published an editorial saying the big problem here is the Iron Dome. Because if Israel didn't have the Iron Dome, they would have to negotiate a peaceful political settlement.
So if they didn't have a defense system, they would have to negotiate with terrorists.
That is correct. So terrorism would be more effective if there wasn't a defense against it. That's what the Washington Post, the nation's capital's newspaper, the newspaper of Amazon, would have you believe that the answer is let terrorists prevail so that you capitulate to them and that you have no defense for them. Look it up. I'm not kidding you. This is what they said. Same mentality as Minnesota's idiot congresswoman. Now, she left out the fact that the clash actually happened after Friday prayers back at the end of Ramadan, not at the end of the ceasefire. Oops.
Oops.
She left out the part that, well, that Hamas and the Palestinian Authority encouraged Muslims to riot, to kill Jews. And then across the country, citizens of Israel, Muslims who have been given citizenship of Israel, went off to attack and kill Jews. and that Israel only responded and attacked Gaza to stop the barrage of rockets. And if George Bush hadn't forced Israel to give up Gaza to these Fakistanians, we would have tens of thousands of rockets there. And what in the hell is wrong with Muslims? That you're so brave, you hide among your women and children?
Nah, 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 you can't get me.
Is there any Muslim out there that's got any courage? Any Muslim out there that has any character? You go and you hide under the dresses of your women, make your children your shields, and then you whine like babies when they get killed. And then you've got the progressives who are so irrational and so misinformed, they make it sound like Israel's the aggressor. Well, there's more Muslims being killed than there are Jews. That's because the rockets that the Pakistanians are shooting are nothing but advanced pipe bombs. It's because they're living in a bygone era. It's because of their incompetence. It's because they store their rockets underneath schools and churches, under schools and mosques and hospitals. We have reached a period of time that is exceedingly lost, where very few people are rational, and that particularly among younger people, they adopted the religion of socialist secular humanism. They don't know if there's a God or not. They actually don't care. And their religion has become secular humanism. And in secular humanism, with multiculturalism and political correctness, facts no longer matter. You can be completely irrational and be considered enlightened and progressive. There's an article today that came out in Fox News, and it says that to be a Jew living in California, New Jersey, New York is to be attacked. Here's a example, a BMW sedan pulled up next to a group of Jews saying, "Free Palestine, F the Jews, your mother effers. Go back to where you came from. Get out of here." Well, they came from Jerusalem. They came from Judea. They came from Israel, the land that you're occupying and crying over, you idiot. You know, when I was writing, I had published Prophet of Doom, and I did some 10,000 radio shows to expose what I had learned. 90% of the Muslims that wrote me wrote with about the same level of intelligence. F the Jews, you mother effers. Yep, that is their intelligence level. And so many even Israelis are to blame. The moment you even acquiesce to the notion that there is a Palestinian and a place called Palestine, then you've played right into their hands. Now, it's a marketing myth that was created around 1950. At the time, the West Bank was part of Jordan. It was not an independent Fakistinian state. Gaza was part of Egypt. No one was complaining that Gaza was occupied or that the West Bank was occupied when they were controlled by Jordan or Egypt. And at the time, there was no mention of a place called Palestine or of Palestinians. It's a Roman Latin myth imposed by Hadrian in 133, when he bludgeoned the Jews and decided to rename the place after their most fierce enemy, an enemy that had been annihilated 600 years before Hadrian's sleight of hand. It is going to get worse for Jews. The world is not listening. There are too few voices like ours willing to tell people the truth. And even when we do, we're subject to all manner of restrictions. Truth is exceedingly unpopular. It can't be, your position can't be justified with evidence and reason if it is counter to the progressives' agenda. Their lies can never be countered, even if evidence and reason prove them to be false. And in this midst, what you're going to have is a rise of conspiracies. The fakestinians have named themselves a Palestinian and have blamed their miserable existence on Jews, when the truth is that the Arab Muslims living in Israel, who were granted citizenship in Israel, were the most prosperous, healthiest, freest, most enlightened Muslims in the world. And they threw all that away when they decided that that was embarrassing and what we really ought to do is kill Jews. The truth doesn't fit their agenda, does it?
Hardly.
So they have a conspiracy. It's kind of like Black Lives Matter. We're going to have a conspiracy. Okay, the truth is that when a black person dies, is killed, it's by the hand of another black person. But that would require us to be responsible and hold ourselves accountable. So we don't like that very much, and our lives are miserable. So we're going to go and blame someone else. That's a conspiracy. That's what Black Lives Matter is. Well, there's no greater conspiracy today than the fakestinian conspiracy, that there's a people known as Palestinians, that they're being oppressed, that their land is being occupied, and that the solution is to give them their own state. Look what happened when the world gave them Gaza. So if you're a Jew, you only have one viable option. The viable option is Yahweh. You will never know him so long as you are religious. If you cling to the customs of your people, if you cling to Judaism, you will be nothing but a victim. It is what has happened over the last 2,000 years. It will continue to happen. Adhering to Jewish customs, adhering to the Jewish religion, has been a deadly and costly mistake for Jews. And after a while, when you've done the same thing with horrible results for 2,500 years, someone ought to say, this is a really bad idea. It's not working out very well for us. Has it ever been better for us? Oh, yeah. Well, it was pretty good under Hezekiah. It was really great under David. Why don't we try what they did instead of what we have done and see how it works out? What a novel idea. Turn to the Torah. Turn to Yahweh. Turn to your prophets. Turn to your Messiah. His name is Dod. Let me introduce you to him. He was king of Yisrael. He is the Messiah. He is the Son of God. He is the chosen one. He is the shepherd. He is the right hand. He wrote the Psalms. He wrote the Proverbs. Second only to Yahweh, he is the foremost named person throughout the prophets. He is the most brilliant and articulate man who ever lived. Listen to what he has to say. And listen to what Yahweh has to say in his Torah. Let's turn now to Shemoth names, Exodus 4:5. That's where we left off this time last week. It reads, the purpose of this account is for them to trust and rely upon the reality that Yahweh appeared to you, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Yishak, the God of Jacob. Well, there's an interesting statement that seems pertinent. The purpose of this account is for them to trust and rely upon the reality that Yahweh appeared to you. That's to Moshe, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Yishak, and the God of Jacob. Well, if he appeared to Moshe, why don't you read what he inspired Moshe to write? Why would you turn to the idiotic arguments of men in the Talmud and pretend that, well, the Talmud is the book for Jews? When Yahweh said, trust and rely on the fact that I appeared to Moses. His name is Moshe. It means to draw out. The Israelites were freed and the Torah was revealed so that we might come to trust and rely upon Yahweh. And the transition, in our previous program, we talked about how the staff became a serpent and then back to a staff. That was symbolic of Satan oppressing mankind between Eden and the millennial Shabbat, where Yahweh's sheep returned to his protective care, and that shepherd's staff is returned to the capable hands of Dodd. Aman, which is the word translated for them to trust and rely, is a marvelous Hebrew word, in addition to saying that we should have the confidence to trust and rely upon Yahweh. It confirms that his word is verifiable and true, consistent and enduring. So I would ask, why would anyone have a religious faith or religious beliefs if God is Aman? Can you name a single reason? Someone asked in the chat room, where are we translating this from? Where are we presenting this text? It is the second chapter of volume four of the recently rewritten series of Yada Yahweh. I'm not sure that Volume 4 is actually published any place yet, since I'm about 10 pages from finishing the final chapter upon which it will be presented and published. It is stunning to me that God can be trusted and relied upon, that he has used prophecy, telling us what happened in the past, and what will happen in the future, to prove that he exists, to prove that he inspired the text that we are considering. This from Shemoth Names, Exodus 4:5. Aman itself appears 144 times in the Torah, Navi, Vamizbor. On 30 of those occasions, the same three Hebrew letters were pointed Amen by the Masoretes and said to mean verily, truly, and so it be it. From these 30 arbitrary vocalizations, one of God's most meaningful terms was transliterated, Amen. And it became a thoughtless conclusion to billions upon billions of prayers. And that's a shame, because idiots pray, in God's name we pray, Amen. But if you're going to call God's name Amen, then he is the Egyptian sun god. And I don't think that's what you have in mind. And, of course, it's a shame that a word so rich in meaning, so essential to our relationship with Yahweh, has been rendered as a religious hiccup. But it is actually worse than that. Most Christians, as I say in God's name, I pray Amen. And by so doing, they renamed their god, a god whose name they do not know, and a god whose name they have now besmirched. There is a simple rule that all trustworthy and reliable translators use when rendering one language into another. Translate words and transliterate names. To transliterate is to convey the sound of the name from one language to the next. For example, Osama bin Laden is Osama bin Laden in Arabic, French, and English.
And Swahili.
Yes. That is also true. And Yahweh's name is Yahweh. And Greek and Latin and Hebrew and English and French and German and Chinese. He is Yahweh. Names should always be transliterated. And words should be translated so that we convey the meaning from one language to another. Now, translation is a challenge sometimes because, for example, in Hebrew, all verbs are liberated in time, where in English, there are many tenses, past, present, future, and variations of those tenses. Well, if you want to write it in English, there is no neutral verb that lies outside of the past, present, and future, and yet every verb in Hebrew is that way. We don't have verbs in Hebrew that are constrained in time or expansive in time, like the conjugations in Hebrew, perfect and imperfect. We don't have volitional moods in English, and yet they exist in Hebrew. We don't have stems in English that establish a relationship between the subject and object, and yet they exist in Hebrew. So it's not always that easy to do so. And the Hebrew of Revelation is not the Hebrew spoken today. So sometimes you even have to translate Hebrew into Hebrew.
That's true.
One of the advantages of using English, since it's the language spoken by more Jews than any other language, most popular language in the world. Yet again, Yahweh said to him, please return your hand inside your garment, inside your bosom, he says, within your robe by your heart. Then he moved his hand inside his robe, and he pulled it out from his garment, and behold, his hand was diseased and leprous, looking like snow. So what was the point? Well, the point is that even the most fearsome disease at the time, probably nothing worse than leprosy, because you were guaranteed to die not only a slow and painful and unsightly death, but the moment you got it, you would be ostracized and you would have to live in isolation and you would no longer be able to care for yourself, and yet no one would want to care for you for fear they contract the disease. Probably nothing worse than leprosy. And there, Moshe's hand, he was out there, he's 80 years old, I'm just tending the sheep, you know, I got a good life here, I got myself a good woman, I've got a good father-in-law, life is good, and now I run up to this blazing top of the mountain, this guy is telling me that he's God, he tells me that his name is Yahweh, and that he wants me to go back to Egypt, where I'm wanted for an investigation of murder, and where I tried to help my people, and they turned on me. And he wants me to go back there. And then just for giggles, he gives me leprosy. Somewhere along this point, you'd say, yeah, I think you got the wrong guy, but could I have my hand back? Now he said, return your hand to your clothes. I mean, somewhere along the line, I would have said, okay, this is really not going the way that I intended. Surely you've got a more fun trick in there than giving me leprosy. He said, return your hand to your clothing. So he returned his hand to his robe near his chest. And when he brought it out from his cloak, behold, it had been restored to being like the rest of his flesh. Well, Okay, thank you so much. Now, so long as we do not actively lead people away from God, so long as we do not inhibit access to our Heavenly Father, we can change at any time, change our ways, start relying on Yahweh instead of others, and return to God. It's as simple as acting upon his instructions. He returned his hand to where it had been, followed Yahweh's instructions, he was healed. Still speaking to Moshe about the likely reaction of the children of Yisrael to the validity of their collective mission, Yahweh said. So if it happens that they do not trust or rely, and they do not listen to the sound of your voice, nor to the initial sign, then they may come to recognize as verifiable and trustworthy the voice of the subsequent sign. Kind of interesting, we call it lakol, which is the voice. But nonetheless, that these signs should speak. Now, that doesn't mean that the leprous hand and the staff are going to yibber yabber. But what it does mean, if the signs are supposed to speak to us, is that there's a message in these signs. And that message is what should be speaking to us. The initial transformation of the Lahmata, staff, branch, scepter, and sign of the tribes comprising Israel to the serpent representing Satan and then back again should have been sufficient, especially with Moshe gaining control over the adversary. It was rich with uplifting symbolism, which they could have readily accepted. The second sign, however, it would have been a little frightening, which is why it was held in abeyance. Leprosy would have been a death sentence, a slow, debilitating, isolating, humiliating way to die, separated and alone. And that was the unmistakable point. They would endure the fate without Yahweh's intervention. Water is the source of life, as the universal solvent for cleansing, making it the ideal symbol for renewal and cleansing. However, removing the consequence of sin from our mortal souls and restoring us would require something far more valuable, more precious, more vital, life's blood. So this reads, if it happens that they do not trust the combination of these two signs and do not listen to the sound of your voice, next you should obtain some water from the river and pour it out on that which is withered and dried up. It shall transpire that the water, which for the benefit of the relationship you obtain from the river, it shall come to exist as blood within that which is withered and paralyzed. I've talked about this before, but I have a real tough time with some of this, in that I'm not a fan of signs and wonders. I think that signs and wonders are for people who are not very smart. I'm not saying that I'm smart, but I just think that signs and wonders are there to impress people who aren't willing to take the time to reason through the evidence. If you take the time to read what Yahweh said and analyze it, compare it to science and history, compare it to other things that he said, look and examine closely his prophecies, you're going to come to know him, trust him, realize that he inspired these words, know that he exists, and you're going to learn a lot in the process. It is the proper way to know and recognize that Yahweh exists and that he sent the likes of Moshe. I think there's very little benefit, and to a large degree, I think it's counterproductive. to rely on signs and wonders. So you might impress somebody, but they don't know anything more. They haven't learned a thing. They're still wholly dependent. There's no independence that comes from knowledge and understanding.
It's an attention getter at best.
Yeah,
you draw them in and then get them to listen, but that's at best.
Right. But if you were given a choice between that as an attention giver and something that God has said that is truly profound, what would you prefer?
Kind of profound. What you said. Go for the words.
Go for the words. Go for the words. Now, you know, to their credit, you know, they didn't have a copy of the Torah at that time.
No words to examine.
I'm sure all of them were illiterate. And so it was a different situation. They had no freedom. Their lives were miserable. If they stepped out of line, they were killed. And so it was a different time. And so I think God is saying, I'm going to do the signs and wonders shtick here, because I realize the limitations that they're under. We don't have those limitations. So we ought not ever want our credibility to be demonstrated by some great sign.
Oh, babe.
Yeah.
There's a reason Yahweh uses those only sparingly.
Correct. He's not a show-off, and they don't do us any good.
Well, let me show you something else you can find on this. I looked at two words, if I may, shifak, and the root of it is to pay in the cough, the mouth and the hand, which means a flask from a horn, and it's for storing medical or ritual oils and to be poured out. And that's what the cough is for, is to pour out in this case. So it is. I look at it like a metaphor. And then right followed that is the yabasha, which is mitzrayim, which is to be is dry ground, land void of water. And, of course, water is life. So mitzrayim is a dried up and withered. And the root there is the bet. And the shin, which is a wither, is to be withered, to be stick, to be a withered, a dry, rot, shame of being withered up. There's a, from wetlands that have dried up where the fish and the vegetables and that die and then they begin to smell. So what I'm looking at is what he's doing. He's trying to heal them from a land of Mitzrayim, which is all dried up and weathered, and in particularly, it stinks. It is a horrible sham because of religion and politics. So if you look at it that way, then it's a pretty darn good symbol, even though I know he's trying to do it to get their attention.
Of course, too, for the Egyptians, or even for the Hebrews, in the Black Land, as it was called, Black Land because of the silt from the river. The river was life. The river was life. Not only was the river of God, the river was life. And so for the soil that the river brought, that fed them, that made it possible to live there, for it to be withered and paralyzed, to be desolate and shriveled up, was a sign that the very thing that they relied upon for life had failed. That God could cause the thing that was most important to these people to fail miserably, and that the fluid of life is our blood. If we bleed out, if our heart stops pumping, we die.
You did.
If we bleed out and our blood is spilled, we die. And so the river, the land was parched by it, but God brought the fluid of life to that which was parched. So if they were paying attention, if they were open to the prospect of being rescued, these examples would have been sufficient to engender trust and reliance upon Yahweh. Collectively, They demonstrated power over Satan's influence on behalf of Israel, trusting God sufficiently to be healed by him rather than endure a slow, debilitating death and isolation, and blood renewing those who are withered and paralyzed. And yet, they were not only for Moshe and the children of Israel, but for us as well. While we did not witness them personally, with the benefit of hindsight and with our access to the whole canvas God has painted for us, we can see how these three word pictures reinforce and confirm vital aspects of Yahweh's plan. And once one recognizes the pieces to this puzzle and understands how they fit together, the artist who composed them appears before our eyes. And he is merciful and approachable, trustworthy and reliable, the ultimate teacher, and we have the opportunity to be his students.
Cool.
Now, the next 16 statements, you're going to, do you want to add to that, Kirk?
Oh, no, sir. I was just saying, cool.
Okay. Yeah. The next 16 statements are none of them are extant in the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's a little unfortunate because in the context of what we are reading, there really is no rational basis for Moshe to say, my Lord, although there is a rabbinical one. Yahweh has been explicit. Mm-hmm. He told Moshe that his one and only name for all people and for all time was Yahweh. He not only instructed Moshe to use it, he explicitly said that Yahweh is the only name he wanted to use in reference to him. Therefore, rather than omit what I suspect was a Masoretic addition, I'm simply going to render it, rather than as Adonai, as Edonai. Written exactly the same way in Hebrew, there's no difference in the letters. It's just the way that they are vocalized or the diacritical marks. One, though, has a more appropriate meaning. Then Moshe said to Yahweh, please, my upright and firm one. Boy, I can assure you that Moshe would have seen Yahweh as firm, entrenched, recalcitrant. I am not a man of words, neither yesterday nor the days before, nor from the time you spoke to your partner in this work. Indeed, my mouth is heavy, stubborn, and unresponsive, and my tongue is challenging and slow. You know, I write up to 10, 12 hours a day. I do it 6 days a week. After a while, I don't care how poor a writer I may have been when I began this, you do gain some aplomb at the craft. I've now done probably 20,000 of these radio programs. I don't claim to be particularly entertaining or insightful or articulate. But after you've done it for 20 years, you develop some skill. I acknowledge that my pronunciation of words is not as good as it should be. Like I stumble all over the woman, the young child, she was 6 years old, Aisha, that was Muhammad's plaything when he had the, following the satanic versions, rode the wild ass to Jerusalem. Moshe's response for a guy who's claiming that he is not a man of words was really articulate. I mean, I want to read this to you again. And you tell me if it sounds like a person who was inarticulate and that had a tough time phrasing his thoughts. Then Moshe said to Yahweh, please, my upright and firm one, I'm not a man of words. Neither yesterday nor the days before, nor from the time you spoke to your partner in this work. Indeed, my mouth is heavy, somewhat stubborn and unresponsive, and my tongue is challenging and slow. Sounds plenty articulate to me. But clearly, Moshe either considered himself inadequate and unqualified, which would have made him adequate and qualified in working with Yahweh, because Yahweh likes those who recognize they are inadequate and unqualified. Or Moshe recognized that he had already tried to save his people, and rather than appreciate what he was doing, rather than support what he was doing, they turned against him. They mocked him. They said, you know, who made you God over us? You know, we saw you kill the Mitzri.
Egyptian.
Well, are you here to kill one of us? Yeah, I don't use the term Egyptian unless it's by
mistake.
Yeah. I do use it, but it's only because it's hard to get the myth out of our minds. Mitzraim, which is the plural of Mitzra, which is from the Hebrew tsur, means to be confined, to be troubled, to be oppressed, to be persecuted. It's a cauldron or a crucible of religious and political oppression. God goes out of his way to explain specifically what he was taking the children of Israel away from, and it is clearly religious and political persecution. And so understanding what Mitzrayim means is essential, because we now understand what God is trying to withdraw us from, not only then, but as Moshe said, not only yesterday and the days before, but now that you are speaking to the one you're asking to work with you, it's all the same. Mitzrayim paints the picture of Yahweh wanting to remove the stigma and stain, the stench of religion and politics from us, because those things are oppressive. They deprive us of our rights and our ability to even be rational. That's why the congresswoman from Minnesota is so irrational. Religion did it to her. So it's one of those two reasons. But from God's perspective, he does like using flawed implements, because to be effective, he knows that they will have to remain dependent upon him. And God realizes that when a perfect result is achieved using an imperfect tool, some people will recognize, wait a minute, that implement was powered by someone who knew what they were doing, someone who could be trusted and relied upon. Now, there are currently 16 volumes in the Yada Yada series. There will be 25 or more when we're done. There are insights on virtually every page of those that are profound. There are hundreds and hundreds of insights that have not been even considered, much less shared, in well over 2,000 years. If someone who has no training in Hebrew, if someone who has no theological education whatsoever, if someone who spent their life in pursuit of business objectives, upon retirement, can do that, it ought to cause anybody that's rational to pay attention and say, wait a minute. There has to have been a superior force behind that. Now, It's also true that Yahweh likes using people who have been exposed to and have subsequently rejected what he is opposed to, because it enables Yahweh to have a shared basis of understanding. And that's really helpful. Now, we've talked about how Dodd, who is the most beloved, had a really terrible relationship with his family. I mean, there was rape and murder, insurrection, rebellion. It was really nasty. Even incest. And so one of the things that Dodd would have been sympathetic about is what Yahweh was enduring when his family, the children of Israel, have acted so heinously towards him. If you want to appreciate God's perspective and his frustration with us, and you have an absolute perfect family where mom and dad were in love, they were great parents, they were kind and nurturing and supportive and uplifting and empowering to their children, and your siblings are all loving and supportive and committed to doing the right thing and people of character, and you find the perfect spouse whom you love and adore and who is supportive and shares common interests, shares your love and devotion for the Torah and for Yahweh and for the covenant, and your children are practically perfect. How in the heck are you going to go about understanding what Yahweh was going through? If you're engaged in politics and think man's way is just peachy keen, if you're a proponent of religion and think that it leads to God, there is not a prayer in the world that God can use you. You're too far apart. And so God needs people who have suffered, who know what it's like to have a broken family, who know what it's like to be publicly humiliated for things they haven't even done, who have backbone, who are willing to stand up. Look at Moshe. He had it all, and yet he went through the defense of a Hebrew that was being beaten to death by an Egyptian and risked his life to protect the innocent man. That's character. So Dodd never backed down from an enemy of his people. Character. And so Yahweh likes men and women with backbone and character. He likes men and women with passion that are willing to engage and go where his words lead. And he likes working with people who've been exposed and have come to reject religion and politics, which Moshe is our prime example. Mm-hmm. And yet people who recognize, well, you know, I'm not the most articulate person in the world. I'm not skilled at the craft of translating, so I need to be reliant. Moshe was all of those things. So when Moshe told God, "Now I want you to find somebody else," there was no one else. I dare say that for most of human history, for the past 6,000 years, there's been almost no one. Sometimes there has been no one. Not a single person that God can communicate through.
Since the last prophet. Yeah.
And in this particular case, he's going to communicate through a Israelite and take that Israelite such that they would have an audience with the Pharaoh of Mitzrayim and speak on behalf of his people and Yahweh's people with an abject hatred of the religion and politics of Mitzrayim that had caused their torment. Would you like to guess how many people there were at the planet 3,450 years ago when this occurred?
One.
A broken down shepherd out there
Arabia,
tending sheep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what now is Arabia? Well, it was even Arabia back then. We don't actually know if Moshe had a speech impediment. We don't know if he stuttered. We know that he was not a fast talker or a man of many words. The slowest well-known speaker that I have ever listened to and subsequently met is Henry Kissinger. Part of Henry Kissinger's spiel was that he communicated words very slowly, such that you would hang on every thought.
The pregnant pause.
He was the master of pacing. And it's very possible that Moshe had the same gift. We have all read Dabarim. What does Dabarim mean?
It's his words.
It means words.
Words.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What part of Dabarim is Moshe responsible for?
All of it, isn't he?
All of it. So.
He's pretty
every
good
one
talker.
Of us has read it.
Pretty good.
Every
writer.
One of us has read it.
Yeah.
It's articulate. It's rational. It's logical. It's accurate. It's vital. It's beautifully written. Beautifully spoken. And it is filled with words. Many, many words. So clearly Moshe was not inarticulate. The word...
May I suggest?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying maybe it's not... Maybe what... There's a difference in... I make a lot of mistakes on the show in things that I know just because I don't speak fast enough I don't get it out of my mouth.
You think faster than you speak.
Yes.
Which is, by the way, a better problem than my problem because sometimes I speak faster than I think.
No. Let me tell you what you can do that is rather unique. You can go into any environment and do the rebuttal on the stump. I mean, right, bomb, 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 and get it back. And I have to think. I know what the answer is, and sometimes I have to gather it all in. Now, a lot of it is because you've been dealing with this for 20 years. I mean,
yes.
You've really got it. And maybe
yes.
He was afraid that he knew he could write it. He knew he could talk about it. But there's a difference when you're right there on stage fright, on stage one, even not necessarily stage fright,
mm-hmm.
but on stage one,
mm-hmm.
and they're throwing these questions at you. I do it in art without any problem. I can stand in front of 600
mm-hmm.
people and entertain them and do whatever I want to do there, and they'll applaud. They'll like
mm-hmm.
it. They'll laugh when I want, et cetera, et cetera. But that's my feel.
Mm-hmm.
I know that stuff. This is something else where I would wind up stumbling over my words where you would not. Maybe
well,
that's closer to what he was concerned about. Is,
I don't care what the field is. I'm more articulate in writing when I have time to sit down and think about what I'm going to say before I do it versus talking in person.
Yeah.
Now, my view is that I would rather write than speak, but I find that there is more emotion in the spoken word, more passion.
Mm-hmm.
and the spoken word than there is in the written word. But actually written words come more naturally to me than the spoken word because I like the permanence of them. I like their enduring nature. I like the fact that they are black and white. There's just something to me that is sensationally elegant about the written word. And perhaps what it is that the spoken word is the communication of the electronic realm, the digital age. The written word is very analog. It is very, very analog. It's the means of communicating that has endured for, well, better part of 6,000 years now. The word here that next is ebed. Abad is to work. Ebed is usually translated servant. But in this particular case, partner would be a really good rendering. Mm-hmm. It means co-worker. It means associate. It means to work with. Expending energy for a purpose. And the Ebed and Abad are indistinguishable in the human text. It's simply vowel pointing. Mm-hmm. So based upon the fact that Yahweh has already said that they would be engaging together, one should not see Moshe presenting himself as a servant, but instead as a potential co-worker or associate, although he was not quite yet engaged in the mission. Since Yahweh is on record disavowing the title Lord and indeed using Baal Lord to describe the adversary, it would be exceedingly disrespectful for Moshe to have used my Lord instead of Yahweh.
Not going to do it.
You're not going to have this profound question, who should I tell the children of Yisrael has sent me to you? When they ask me his name, what should I tell them? And then Yahweh says, I am who I am. I am, and I exist for the benefit of the relationship. You may tell them that Yahweh has sent you. It is the only name that I wish to be known as for all of time. That if you had heard that spoken to you directly from God, based upon him answering your question, do you think that 3 minutes later in the middle of that conversation, you're going to have a senior moment and say, I forgot already. What
you mean
was your name? Hey, listen, I'm not good with names.
I mean, the guy who put his hand in and it came out leprosy?
Yeah, I'm not good with names.
You didn't go focus on his name? I think you're going to focus on his name.
I think so. Listen, I'm not great with names either. But I know this one's really important.
I got that one.
I've got this one.
You know your boss's name. You know your wife's name.
Yeah.
Hopefully you're chilling.
Yeah. So Yahweh said to him, who made the mouth of man? Or who could have made him mute, unable to speak, or deaf, unable to hear, or sighted or blind? Was it not me? Oh, by the way, Yahweh?
His name again. Yeah.
loosely translated. What's the matter with you? No.
What's
if I made it, I can make it work. If I had wanted man to be mute, deaf, blind, you'd be dumb, deaf, and blind. Okay? I designed the ears. I designed the tongue. I designed the lips. I designed the mouth. I designed the eye, which is pretty amazing. I have conceived vocal cords. If I can design this, chances are, I can help you with the words that you need to communicate. If I made it, I can make it work. Now, the fact of the matter is Yahweh picks and chooses those with whom he wants to work. Well, at least to the extent that there are choices. And once he decides, he's ready to engage. If he decides, you know, listen, I've read so much and translated so much on Abraham that, you know, I wonder sometimes why in the world God chose this man.
Availability.
But nonetheless, there may not have been any other choices who met the criterion he was looking for. Someone who had come out of Babylon, that was a requirement. Someone who would be willing to go where his words lead. Someone who had left Babylon knowing that he did not want to return. And someone who was at least capable of having a conversation with God. There probably weren't a lot of people on the planet to choose from. So Abraham got the nod. So now we read. So let's go. So let's go. I will actually and continually be interacting with your speech. And I will teach, I will guide, I'm going to instruct you regarding the words which reveal the proper path to the benefits of the relationship. Fellas, if God said that to any one of us, I'd say, okay, where are we going?
Yeah.
I'm going to teach you, I'm going to guide you, I'm going to instruct you regarding the words which reveal the proper path to walk to the benefits of the relationship. I am going to actually and continually be interacting with your speech. So let's go. No one in the right mind would turn that down. Or would they? With the exception of interacting with your speech, isn't God's Torah written such that every person on the planet could read this in first person? God saying, I will teach, I will guide, I will instruct you. Is not Yara the verb?
Mm-hmm.
Which lies at the heart of the word Torah?
Torah, yes.
I will Torah you regarding the words which reveal the proper path to walk to get the most out of the relationship. That is true for every human being on the planet today. If you pick up the Torah, God is going to reveal the words which lead to the relationship. True for all of us. So
yeah,
there's a
wow.
lot more people than Moshe saying, no thanks. It's everyone, but maybe a few hundred, maybe a few thousand of us. Moshe's response was disappointing, and it likely hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, excuse me, sir, release my hand and send out someone else. So do you think that Yahweh was actually holding Moshe's hand?
No, he was referring to his power. Or is he referring to his hand during the action?
It says release my hand, doesn't
it? You think?
It? And that's what it says. Hmm. Please release my
yeah.
hand.
Well, maybe he was.
Shalak ma-yad.
To his arm or something.
And send someone else. Now, how is Yahweh depicted in the original language of the Torah? As a hand reaching out and down. Right. And
yeah.
how is the observant man
reaching up.
Written? Right, man reaching up.
Okay. Stand corrected. Yeah, that's
Why would he say release my hand?
Yeah,
he didn't
right.
say release me. He didn't say let me go.
Let me
didn't
go.
Just say
no
thank
no.
you. He didn't just turn away and walk away. He said, release my hand.
Hmm.
It's like a father to a son. let's go together. It's like, you know, it's like a reluctant child, and you grab their hand and say, let's go, come on, let's go. It's got to be fun. Let's go do this. Excuse me, sir. Please. Release my hand. Send someone else. There was no one else to send. God could not compel Moshe into going without infringing upon his free will. He was not going to liberate slaves with a slave. And yet Yahweh needed Moshe to go with him because he was the only Hebrew on the planet who not only understood the caustic nature of the religious and political oppression his people were suffering in Egypt, but it also rejected it, taken a stand against the abuse, and then walked away. He had the knowledge and the character Yahweh required for this mission at this moment. So after showing his frustration, Yahweh came up with an accommodation. Now, keep in mind, for Yahweh to come up with an accommodation here, for Yahweh to be frustrated, and Moshe said no, what that tells you is that God could not do this on his own.
That's true.
Now, what did Moshe bring to the party?
He had been in the court. He knew the stuff.
He was
also a human being and a family member. Yeah.
He was a human being.
Human being,
yeah.
Yeah, he was from a descendant of Jacob. That's what he was.
Lord, yeah.
And, of course, he had this these other benefits. But Yahweh did not establish the covenant independently. He did it with Abraham. Yahweh did not save mankind with a Nesama independently. He did it with Noach. Yahweh did not establish the state of Israel independently. He did it with Dot. He did not save his people from the Assyrians by himself. He did it with Hezekiah. Yahweh works with us because that's the prime objective. That's what the only reason that the universe exists. So if Yahweh is going to go and do this on his own and go into Mitzrayim with guns blazing,
what's the point?
And, oh, what's the point? What's the point? And it's just another big bully God up there that is manipulative and threatening and the like. No. Everything he does through people. With regard to Moshe, that was deeply concerning and displeasing, even aggravating. Shira'ah was annoying and frustrating, kindling displeasure and resentment for Yahweh. Wow.
Yeah.
That's sad, isn't it?
Keyword, yeah, keyword F. That's a flaming nostril. That's anger.
Yes, it is. It's anger.
Mm-hmm.
He was angry. God has an emotional side. It took a lot to get him to that point. Showing up as a blazing fire on top of the mountain and speaking to a man and your God, you would think that most of your creation would say, wow, all of
sure.
My life I've wanted to actually meet God, and here you are? Oh, yeah. But that's not how it played out, is it?
No. Say no thanks.
No thanks.
Oh,
no thanks. Go find somebody else. I don't want any part of this. So he replied, what about Aaron? the accurate translation of the name Aaron is as an alternative. Okay, it can also be rendered bringer of light and choice.
But
our means presenting a desirable option under the auspices of free will as an alternative, and own is pertaining to enlightenment, or sometimes own is like Shabbaton, means all things, consider everything related to this concept. So I'm providing you with an alternative. That's the name of your brother. Alternative. He's also a Loi. I know that indeed he Dabar.
Dabar.
Hey, Dabar.
I get that way sometimes myself.
I'll repeat a Hebrew word as exponentially, so that means he says a great many things. He just talks incessantly. Yeah, so what's your excuse now?
Touché.
Yeah, so while Yahweh could not compromise his principles or change his approach, he will make personal accommodations when necessary. And this was such an occasion. There was no other option, no other time. The fate of humanity was hanging in the balance. Had Yahweh not rescued his people, he would not have proven himself reliable. He would not have rendered the covenant credible. There would have been no Torah nor prophets. God would have become unknowable, and death would have been the end of life for everyone. So now you know why Yahweh was Chira'am, aggravated, annoyed, frustrated. Moshe's reluctance kindled God's resentment. Should you wonder why Moshe was hesitant, it is not because he was a slow talker, nor because he feared the regime in Mitzrayim. We have seen him confront an armed instrument of the Black Land subjugation, and we have listened to him verbally challenge God's decision. If you're going to challenge what God himself is saying to you, you know, then it's not for a lack of courage or a lack of personal conviction. Therefore, these issues were not responsible for his trepidation. And that leaves us with a rather profound and unflattering insight. Moshe didn't trust his own people. Moshe realized that God would prevail over Pharaoh. But what then? If he could not convince the Hebrews to trust him, to rely upon Yah to liberate them, the result would have been counterproductive, dangerous, humiliating. Now that we're clear in this context, Dabar means that Aaron was a leverman, likely a gossip, which is what we found out later. He could talk the ears off an elephant. Now, speaking of your being a bit verbose with Dabar, now that it's been, 20 plus years that we've been at this. Now, in my case, there was no blazing fire, no signs other than a copy of the 91st Psalm placed in my pocket. I'm certainly not a prophet, nor was I called to be a liberator. And while I considered asking God to find someone else, ostensibly because I was not qualified, and, well, honestly, because the first job was to expose Islam, and Muslims killed people that do that.
That's kind of a thankless job.
It is pretty a thankless job. You know, how many times have I been called and a mother effer like the Muslim there in New York. But I didn't engender Yahweh's frustration by saying no. No. I was willing to do it. I thought were important caveats. God, of course, knew what the caveats I was going to bring. He had already taken care of them. That's why the 91st Psalm was in my pocket. And, well, I actually think that now, 20 years into this collaboration, it's been enjoyable for both of us. I think it's been mutually beneficial. I think God's gotten a lot of what he wanted out of it. I'm not sure I would have said that until the team has come together and we've worked together as a family. And we have done this edit pass, retranslating, rewriting the books. And, you know, now when I see the first 15 on my shelf, and I open them, and I see how they're consistently and beautifully they are presented. And quite honestly, there are parts of it that read really well. I mean, we're dealing with 16 books that average 600 pages apiece. So there's a lot of dunderhead moments, I'm sure, in the process. But nonetheless, there's everything you really need to know about God. And it's presented now for his people such that I think the collaboration has been quite good.
Yeah.
So you're listening to the result. I'm sharing from one of what will be nearly 30 volumes of the Yada Yawa series by being willing to listen to God, by considering what he is sharing with us. He has inspired thousands of insights, many unheralded prior to this time. Now, we always have to look at what was God looking for in having chosen Moshe? What was he looking for in having chosen Dode? What was he looking for in someone like Elias, the prophet, or Yahshuah, or Shemuel? What was God looking for? Why did God reach out to Noah? If we don't do that, how are we going to know what God values in us?
It's always the same.
So when I'm always a little bit nervous when I share a personal anecdote like this, but if I don't, we're missing the point. We should all personalize all of this. We should look at what did Yahweh find in Moshe that caused him to want to work with this individual. And so as I look at my own meeting with God, I figured God wanted three things. He wanted someone who was willing to expose the ills of religion and to leave his people without excuse. He wanted this individual to try to communicate his message as clearly and completely as possible, doing so in the world's most popular language. And third, he wants someone with a shared passion to reconcile his relationship with the very people he was liberating from Mitzrayim, the children of Israel. That's something we can all do. And that's good enough for God. He'll do the rest. God has been grieved by humanity in general and by his people in particular for so long. The truth is, it doesn't take much to please him. Thank goodness. Ultimately, even so, the willing are few and far between. There are so many memorable lines on the way to Passover And that's what this volume is all about, introducing the first three Moed Mikra. But here is now a line from Shemot Names, Exodus 4, 22 and 23. You should say to Pharaoh. So I was assuming that Moshe is out of excuses. He's going to go.
Yeah, he's on the board. He's on the game.
Yeah.
He's on the board right now, I should say. Yeah.
You should say to Pharaoh. Thus says Yahweh. Yisrael is my firstborn child. And I am telling you that it is in your interest to let my son go to work with me. If you do not consent, if you are defiant and refuse to set him free, be aware, I will slay your firstborn. Wow.
Boy, that's scary to walk in there and say that to Pharaoh. Wow.
You know, I don't actually look at it that way.
Well, I don't say
By the time, by this time.
If you just step out and walk into that,
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
Never once did Moshe say, I'm not sure your God proved to be your God.
Oh, no.
He knew he was talking to God. He said, hey, those dunderheads there were beaten to a pulp by the Mitzrayim. They're not privy to this experience. How are they going to know that you, God, actually sent me to them without seeing you themselves?
Mm-hmm.
So he knew he was talking to God. If you knew that God himself was sending you, do you think you're going to have any trepidation on talking to some potentate?
No, I'm just looking at it in the abstract. You know, a man walks into the most powerful man on earth and says, you don't let him go, I'm going to kill your son. That is the speech. Wow.
No,
to be a fly on the wall.
You put me in that same position. Ready to look him right in the eye. I'd give him the old Dodian, you foul-mouthed Philistine, you uncircumcised oath. What in the world are you doing besmirching my people and threatening my country? What are you thinking are you doing here? I'd look him right in the eye and say the same thing. Oh, by the way, boing, take this one.
Yeah. Same scenario.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. You know, speaking for God is such a thrill. It's so enormously liberating. Now, I began this show exceedingly angry at the likes of the Muslims who pretend that there is a place called Palestine that Jews are occupying, and that they're Palestinians, and that they're victims as opposed to perpetrators. I'm exceedingly angry that they have a voice. I'm exceedingly angry that people believe them, and that they're harassing God's chosen people, and that most of the world is not smart enough to figure out that they're lying, and that they are the perpetrators, not the victims. And I know that by saying these things, I'm risking being shut off, canceled from many of the platforms that host this show. I recognize that. I don't care. My calling is not to please men. Moshe's calling was not to impress Pharaoh. His calling was to do as God wanted.
Yeah, we ask. Mm-hmm.
And if you have the opportunity, which we all have, to speak for Yahweh, to speak on behalf of his people, to speak against those who would harm his people, like the Muslims, like the progressives. He ought to have no trepidation in doing so. There is nothing but good that can come of it. We should all be excited, confident, and the opportunity to walk up to the likes of Pharaoh and say, thus says Yahweh, Israel is my firstborn child, and I am telling you that it is in your interest to let my son go, to work with me. If you do not consent and are defiant and refuse to set him free, be aware, I will slay your firstborn. Let me put this in modern-day terms. Israel remains Yahweh's firstborn child. Mm-hmm. If you are among the majority in this world telling Israel that they need to give up Gaza even further, allow Muslims and like Hamas to call it a state and build as, and import as many rockets as they want and weaponize it, and to do the same with the West Bank and to do the same with Jerusalem. God is telling you that it's your interest to not do so. It's in Israel's interest to work with Yahweh. But if you're defiant, if you refuse, if you're going to try to destroy Israel, God's going to take your life in the not too distant future.
Well, you know, I think of some, if I may, in light of calling people out of the United States to go to Israel. They're not on board at all yet. The pressure will come, and then they will go. So, and if nobody can shut this down, this is the call. Nobody's going to shut this down. I don't care what they do. Yahweh wants this done. So it'll be done.
Oh, he's already told us what's going to happen. Dode's going to come back, and he's going to clean house.
Yeah, clean house, yeah.
Yeah.
But they've
if
got
they
to
were
leave
rational,
America. This is just getting awful. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's going to. Yeah, America is becoming exceedingly anti-Semitic. And
so
it's
the
wacko conspiratorial right, and the foundation of all conspiracies is blame the Jews. And then you have the progressive, the academic, the media that are blame the Jews. And then you have the ever-growing number of Muslims blame the Jews. And then you have the Roman Catholic Church blame the Jews. No place for the Jews to hide unless it is concealed by Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh, not thus says Rabbi so-and-so in the Talmud. Israel is my firstborn child. Christians, if you were rational, since Israel is God's firstborn, what kind of a father would he be to abandon his child and then embrace those who have tortured and tormented that child?
That's right.
Wouldn't one have to be crazy to trust such a God and want to live in his company? The notion of replacement theology, which is the basis of Christianity. Without replacement theology, there is no Christianity. If the Gentile church did not replace Jews, Israel, then they have no basis. And the notion that God threw out his children and embraced those who have tortured his children is utter nonsense. It is interesting that Pharaoh was offered the opportunity to make the right choice. Shylock was conveyed in the imperative mood, giving Pharaoh, as a dictator, and as a slave driver, the opportunity to decide the fate of his own son. Since Pharaoh had chosen to enslave the Hebrews and kill every son born to them, God's offer was quite generous. He could have said that, if you do not let them go, I will torment you for 400 years and then kill your people. And that would have been fair. See the difference? Mm-hmm. If you do not let my firstborn go, I will kill your firstborn. Versus God saying, because you've tortured my children for 400 years, because you've enslaved them for 400 years, you deprived them of all rights for 400 years, you made their lives miserable for 400 years, and now you're killing them after having tortured them, I think I'll do the same to you.
Yeah, quid quo. What is it, quid pro quo?
Yeah. Well, that would have been fair. There is an unexpected twist in Yahweh's statement that we should also consider. Yisrael was being freed to work with Yahweh. Their purpose and mission was just beginning. They would become the messengers and exemplars for all mankind. God is saying, you're forcing them to work for you for nothing, making buildings of mud that are going to blow down and weather in the torrential rains. Be no living, lasting legacy of any of this. And instead, I'm going to ask them to work with me. And the legacy of those words, of our relationship, will endure forever. You're building nothing, a miserable place to live in a miserable country out of mud blocks, O weaselly man. You know what Pharaoh actually means in Hebrew?
No, what's that?
Flee. Flee.
Flee, does he really?
Flee, flee.
Like
you annoying little flea.
Like Agbar is a rat and he's a flea.
He's a flea. Allah's a mouse. And Allahu Akbar means Allah is a mouse.
Let me write
that down. Allahu Akbar. Akbar is mouse in Hebrew. Allahu Akbar means Allah is a mouse and Pharaoh means flea. You little flea.
I love God's language.
You're forcing my people to make mud huts. And no, what we're going to do here is they're going to work with me. And what we're going to build is the covenant relationship. What we're going to build is the enduring legacy of the Torah. What we're going to build is life in seven dimensions for all time. That's the comparison here. He was not freeing his people to come up with 1,000 ways to do nothing on the Shabbat. He wasn't freeing them to bob their heads up and down and pray at a crumbling wall. He wasn't freeing them to be enslaved by the Babylonians or the Assyrians or the Romans or the Roman Catholics or the Nazis. God wanted his people to work with him. For 20 years now, that's what we've done. We've worked with Yahweh. Before 6 o'clock this morning, I was in this seat doing that very thing. It's what God wants. He wants us to work with him. Even Adam was created to work with God in the garden. God values work, creating value, creating a legacy of something that has meaning and that endures and that is good and right and beneficial. And so the odd twist in it is that you're forcing them to work for nothing. And I'm going to work with them.
They can work for the greatest event of all.
The greatest reward ever. What we're going to accomplish together is eternal, everlasting, multiplicitous, such that rather than being a puny little flea in the sands of Mitzrayim, they're going to soar in seven dimensions throughout the universe as my sons and daughters. How's that for a contrast?
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
The moral of the story is that God wants us to engage with him, serving with him on behalf of the covenant family. Our labor together is not only enjoyable, enriching, and enlightening, it has eternal rewards. God does not want us to advance the cause of man because it always turns out badly. Yisrael was called out of the crucibles of religious and political oppression to serve as a paradigm for all of the covenant's children. Their path from man to God is memorialized in the seven mikra invitations to be called out and meet, which began with Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. Now, this is not to say that the Israelites were a good example, one that we should seek to emulate. Their fidelity could be measured in milliseconds, and their fluctuation between trust and denial was not unlike the undulations recorded by an active seismograph. The religious milieu of Mitzrayim had corrupted them, just as would their Babylonian experience almost 1,000 years thereafter. So let's end this program on this statement. We'll pick it up at the same place this time next week.
Certainly.
Aaron, the alternative, conveyed all of the words which to show the way to the benefits of the relationship Yahweh had spoken to Moshe. And then he engaged to perform the signs in the sight of the people. So the family trusted and relied when they heard that indeed Yahweh could be counted upon because he had assessed the situation of the children of Yisrael. He had seen their miserable oppression and debilitating persecution, Onehem, their harassment and suffering, affliction and poverty of the children of Yisrael. And they were inclined to express themselves, declaring their intent. Kirk, there's some marvelous words, JB, that we will analyze next week on this. Of course, it ends with Chawa, which means to express oneself, to declare one's intents, to be articulate, to announce one's objective. It's a demonstrative and declarative term. It's not how it's rendered in English Bibles. There is also Pakad, which is that Yahweh could be counted upon because he had assessed the situation, followed by Oni, which is as nasty a word as there is. Mm-hmm. It defines what he witnessed in Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim was Oni, miserable, oppressive, debilitating, harassing, afflicting, impoverishing, subjugating, debasing. There isn't anything capable of doing that to this extent for an entire people unless the motivation behind those things, the cause of those things, is religion or politics. God has defined the experience in Mitzrayim. So that's something for us to think about between this time and a week from now. May Yah bless. May more people listen to Yah's message. May we awaken people such that the Palestinians and progressives lose their voice so that the children of Israel find their voice, so that more and more people, particularly the chosen people, choose to listen to Yahweh. You've been listening to your forefathers and listening to your cultural edicts and listening to your rabbis, and it has been nothing but one miserable experience after another. It's time to change. Go back to what worked for Dod, for Hezekiah, for Noach. Listen to Yahweh instead. Establish your relationship with him. He can not only protect you in the here and now, but he can establish you for all time, adopt you as his child, raise you up to live with him in heaven. And all of that is beautifully articulated and presented throughout the Torah and prophets. So may Yah bless. Look forward to being with you this time next week. Good night, Joe.
Thanks, guys. Shalom.
Shalom.